I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, work and study, the Awabakal and Worimi peoples. I extend that to the land on which our listeners meet. I pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. Thank you to our sponsor, Espresso Warriors Qatar. The CCJS would like to invite you to our upcoming International Women's Day event on Tuesday, 8 March at Local Connections, starting at 6 p.m, where we have a superb lineup of female panelists and delicious food, as well as our start of semester drinks at the Newcastle Hotel on the 24th of March. Welcome back to the UON CRIM podcast for 2022. I am your brand new host, Jessica Horn. I am a third year business and law student at the University of Newcastle, and I am so thrilled to be here, bringing you some new, exciting content in the criminology and law space in the coming months. In today's episode, I talk with Stephen Ryan, who is a criminal barrister called to the bar in 2016. He appears in criminal trials, sentences, and appeals in Newcastle, the Hunter region, the Central Coast, and the Mid-North Coast. He advises those under investigation and provides advocacy for those already before the courts. He has defended clients charged with drug supply, firearm offences, and serious violence offences. Let's get into it. Welcome, Mr. Stephen Ryan. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
That's good. All right, let's get started. So, for those listeners who may not be aware, what is a barrister and what is the difference between a barrister and a solicitor?
So, a barrister is a lawyer, like a solicitor, who generally specialises in advocacy in the courtroom, representing people or companies. They specialise in what we'll call litigation, that is, a solicitor might go to a barrister to provide advice on how a matter should be run in court, what pleadings should be drafted. They might ask the barrister to draft the pleadings. And a solicitor can do a lot of those things, but barristers are considered to be sort of specialists at appearing in court, advising on litigation, and helping prepare matters for court, generally speaking.
Yeah. And how long have you been a barrister, and have you always specialised in criminal law?
I've been at the bar about 5.5 years now, and I would say probably 80% of my practice is criminal law, and the other 20% would be a mix of civil law, such as contract disputes, work in the Fair Work Commission, unfair dismissals, things like that. But overwhelmingly, most of the work I do is in criminal law.
Yeah. And what made you pursue a career in law?
Well, I was a newspaper reporter first, and I was probably about 18 or 19 when the paper I worked for first sent me to the local court to cover the local court, and then I was sent to cover the district court, which is generally where barristers appear.
Yeah.
And that's when I sort of had first contact with the law in that way. And then after about 10 or 15 years as a newspaper reporter, I started to get a bit bored with it, and then I looked into studying law. And that's what I did when I was about 31, 32. And I really wanted to go to the bar straight away, which is what I ended up doing.
Amazing. And is there an exam for the bar?
There is. Once upon a time, you had to complete 3 3-hour exams.
Wow.
On a Monday, a Wednesday, and a Friday. And the New South Wales Bar Association would have them in February, I think, and then again in about July or August. Now it is two-hour exams on the one day, and they are a mix of problem-solving questions and shorter questions. And I think they now do them on laptop computers, whereas it was handwritten when I did it.
Back in the day.
And they cover the topics of evidence, which is obviously something barristers have to have a strong understanding of, practice and procedure, mainly civil practice and procedure, and ethics, because we have slightly different ethical rules to solicitors given our slightly different relationship with the clients.
Yeah, such as working for yourself.
That's right. So we're independent, whereas a solicitor can work for themselves or they might work for a law firm,
mm-hmm.
Whereas we are independent advocates, even though most barristers share offices and facilities together around Australia.
Yeah, and people may have heard of chambers.
Yes.
And that's that office.
Correct. It's just an old term that we inherited from the British. And in Sydney, there are a number of buildings and floors where barristers gather in chambers.
Mm-hmm.
Some floors have, I think the largest floor of chambers in Sydney has close to 100 barristers on that particular floor,
mm-hmm.
practicing in all areas of the law. Some chambers specialise in certain areas of the law, such as family law, or building and construction, or employment law, or something like that.
Yeah.
Some specialise in criminal law. Some floors can be very competitive to get into because they have a waiting list of barristers that would like to be on that floor, whereas others work independently on their own and might be out in the suburbs of Sydney or out in the country towns practicing in various areas of the law.
Yep. And sometimes you hear of a SC or a QC.
Yes.
What are they?
So QC stands for Queen's Counsel and SC stands for Senior Counsel. And once upon a time, again, this is something we inherited from the British, and if there is a male monarch, then it becomes King's Counsel. Once upon a time, it actually meant that you were then, if you became a King's Counsel or a Queen's Counsel, you were actually senior enough to do certain work in the superior courts. These days, in Australia at least, it simply marks that you are a revered, respected barrister of so many years' experience. It may be that you are a specialist in a particular area and a leader in that particular area of the law.
Yep.
Or it might mean that you have a more generalist practice, but you are eminent and very well experienced in certain areas of the law.
Yep.
In particular, they want you to have a strong appeals practice.
Mm-hmm.
That is, appearing in the Court of Appeal or the Court of Criminal Appeal and even the High Court. So in New South Wales, I think it was around 1990, maybe a bit before or a bit after, that the role was changed, the name was changed to Senior Counsel.
Yeah.
And it's actually caused a bit of contention every now and then because there are some barristers who practice internationally,
mm-hmm.
who worry that because we only refer to Senior Counsel in New South Wales by that name, that it doesn't sound as prestigious
right.
as Queen's Counsel. Because a lot of jurisdictions, I think the Brits still have Queen's Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're conducting international arbitrations and all this sort of work, then they think it sounds more impressive if you're a Queen's Counsel. So that's essentially it. And they're appointed now by the New South Wales Bar Association.
Yeah, so mostly experience.
Mostly experience and the quality of your work.
Yeah.
I understand it's a very detailed process now where you have to keep a log of the cases you appear in,
right.
the results. Those who are unsuccessful are often told you need to be appearing in the more senior courts,
mm-hmm.
you need to be appearing in appellate courts.
Yeah.
And they then check with your opponents
mm-hmm.
and the various judicial officers you appear in front of. What's this person like? Are mm-hmm. they really that good? That sort of thing is done.
Yeah, so also be kind to your opponents.
Be kind, be courteous.
So, if you're arrested, either for a minor, serious crime, what exactly are your rights and what do you do in that moment?
Well, it depends on the situation, but the number one rule I tell clients who either are under arrest or are about to be arrested or have had a phone call from the police is don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to say anything, and by rights, the police should always warn you that you don't have to say anything, and anything that you do say can be used against you
mm-hmm.
Later on in court. It will astonish you how many clients do not adopt that advice and do start
yep.
talking because they think they can get themselves out of trouble or
yep.
whatever it is they've got themselves into. But that's the most fundamental right that you have. You don't have to talk. I always say to clients, look, be courteous with the police. Never mouth off or be short with them. It just makes things far more difficult for you. Just politely say you will be invited for an interview. You will be invited to state your case. Just very politely say, no thank you, no thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Because it will amaze you how many times that a client or a witness gives an interview to police and, to put it bluntly, they bugger things up for themselves.
You get the CD and you're like...
And not only that, but you'll have clients who say, I did what you said and I didn't say anything to the police. And then a couple of months down the track, the brief of evidence turns up and there's a record of interview included in the brief. And you will say to the client, I thought you said you didn't say anything. I have a CD here with your interview.
Saying
I have a
something.
Transcript of what you said. Oh, yeah, I didn't think that mattered. I didn't think you meant that. Oh, okay. So that's the most basic right. I'm not aware of any right to call a lawyer or anything like that that a lot of people see
not
on
like
TV,
the movies.
In the movies, on Law and Order. But the police will always... I'm not aware of any case where someone's asked to speak to a lawyer and they've been refused, unless they can't get a lawyer on the phone or what have you.
Yeah.
Certainly I've received calls. I know a lot of solicitors and barristers who've received calls to confirm whatever the instructions you know, or the advice is to the client.
And
that's the most basic, you know.
Basic. What's the latest time you've been called?
Probably not too late. Probably only at about 8.
Okay, not bad.
Most clients will have... If the police are after them, the police will usually try and, if they can't track them down, call them or call a parent or call around at the house.
Yeah.
So I have not been woken at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. Police will usually only conduct an arrest like that if they have witnessed the crime themselves, and it's a serious crime.
Mm-hmm.
So you said earlier, even for minor offences, if someone's arrested, generally speaking, for a minor offence, you won't be arrested. They might just issue you with a court attendance notice.
Yeah.
If you're charged with, you know, offensive language or possessing a small amount of cannabis or something like that, the police might just give you a ticket and say it's a fine of $400 or whatever it might be. Or they might say, this is a court attendance notice. You are charged, a bit like when you get a ticket for speeding on the side of the road.
Yeah.
You don't normally get arrested for that unless you're doing 180 in a 100 zone or something like that.
Yeah.
They will give you a ticket to appear in court, and if you want to plead guilty, you can plead guilty and get sentenced, or if you want to challenge it, you plead not guilty. So it's really only for the more serious offences, and even for the more serious offences, if the police have knocked on your door and found a couple of dozen cannabis plants in your backyard or something like that, they might arrest you and charge you with cultivating a prohibited plant or something. But if you've got no record and you can agree to be of good behaviour whilst the matter goes to court, quite often the police will grant you bail.
Themselves.
Yes, and release you and you can attend court at a future date.
Alrighty, good advice. What would you do if you were asked to work on a case that went against your morals? Has this ever happened to you and what did you do?
Well, that question presupposes that I have morals. In all seriousness, I've had a handful of clients who have either done something reprehensible or they themselves are reprehensible for whatever reason. And as a barrister, you cannot refuse the brief on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
So you treat them like you would treat any other client. You would read the brief like you would for any other client, provide whatever advice they need to hear. One thing that barristers have to maintain is what's called disinterestedness. That is, we provide our advice and advocacy on behalf of clients, not with any emotional attachment or anything like that, I guess you would describe it. And it is certainly easier in those cases to maintain disinterestedness when you think, okay, this person has been charged with doing this, or I really can't tolerate this client, mm-hmm. but I have a duty to provide them with advice and to advocate on their behalf in court. And you just get on with the job.
Yeah.
You avoid becoming close to clients. You're never friends with a client, and you have to explain that to them sometimes.
Straight up.
Yep. Some of them, I've had conferences with clients where they'll be the solicitor and myself talking about their matter, and it could appear as though things are becoming too friendly, or they might want to suggest catching up after the case or something, and I will tell them straight up, no, we're not your friends.
This is my job.
That's right, but this is in your interest, all right? It's in your interest that we're not friends, because I'm giving you the best advice. With ice running through my veins, I'm not emotionally attached to you or your case. It's in your best interest that we're all cool, calm and collected over here when we consider your matter. And they always understand
that. Yeah, yeah.
Every client I've had to say that to has understood.
Well, that's good. No people coming knocking at your door for dinner.
Exactly, exactly. I had one client once suggest that after his matter was over, that he wanted myself and the instructing solicitor to march with him in the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras.
And what was your answer to that?
We had to diplomatically sort of decline.
Respectfully decline.
Respectfully decline, because he was charged with some very serious sex offences for which he was jailed.
Oh.
And he thought he was innocent.
Right.
And so we said, look, maybe you might have diplomatically dealt with it. Look, maybe we can consider that at the end, but at the moment we just need your instructions on this particular matter now.
Oh, that's great. So I guess that leads on to my next question. So a lot of people, when I say I work for a solicitor who does criminal law, is how can you defend criminals? Don't you feel ashamed? So what's your answer to that?
Okay. I reckon only 10%, maybe 20% at the most, of my clients who I've represented are truly bad. Mm-hmm. And when I say bad, I mean a pretty broad definition. That is, they've either done something completely disgraceful, or they themselves are just a completely disgraceful person. Mm-hmm. Most people who, from my observations, are generally good people who've made a mistake,
yeah,
or done something stupid, or done something they wouldn't ordinarily do. By way of example, I've represented a lot of people who've got into fights and done things whilst under the influence of alcohol. And that doesn't mean they're a bad person. It might mean they've got a drinking problem.
Yeah.
It might mean they shouldn't drink, but it doesn't mean they're a bad person.
It's not who they are.
In terms of the disgraceful ones, we have a duty to represent them. And even some of those who've done truly disgraceful things, very few of them are genuinely awful or evil. Mm-hmm. Even those with shocking criminal records, and believe me, I've represented plenty of those, you can read a psychologist's report into their background, and a lot of the time that starts to piece together, yep, why.
It's usually the background.
It's often the background. Yeah. It doesn't excuse what they do, because they can be a real pain in the neck in the community, but at least it provides some explanation for why they behave the way they do, or yep, why they do what they do. So I hope that answers that question.
It does. Because
clients come in all shapes and forms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it does. So what happens when you give your client advice and they instruct you or want to do the opposite?
So we have about 120 or 122 bar rules, mm-hmm, and there is actually a number of bar rules that deal with how to deal with a client who might provide you with certain instructions. And there is one bar rule in particular which effectively says, if a client confesses their guilt to you but insists on maintaining a plea of not guilty, mm-hmm, then first of all, we are duty bound to retain the brief, but it means that effectively we are not allowed to run what you might call a positive case against the prosecution case or against the case. And what that means is you can put the prosecution case to the test, you can test the evidence in court, you can submit to the jury that based on this evidence you would not be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt, but you can't go cooking up a positive case like it could have been someone else, or here's a video we obtained earlier, or anything like that. And those cases can arise. So, for example, you might have a male client who is charged with, say, a sexual assault, and he might tell you or the solicitor that, yes, I had sex with this woman, but I can't admit to it because I can't admit it to my wife, therefore I'm going to plead not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when that happens, you have to explain to them the effect these rules, and it may, and you have to tell them, I cannot do this, I cannot do that, I can only put the prosecution case to the test. And quite often that may mean that they need to brief another barrister, and you return the brief. So that's how you deal with those. Most of those tricky sort of ethical situations are dealt with under our bar rules.
Yeah, all right. And without obviously giving too much away, what is the most serious case that you have been involved in, and how long did it go for?
The most serious case? Last year, I represented a male nurse in a psychiatric hospital who had sexual contact with a patient.
Mm-hmm.
That matter ran for about 2 years. It concluded with a trial in the district court in front of a judge alone. The accused, well, offender was found not guilty of two charges, the two most serious charges, which were of sexual intercourse. But there were about another five or six charges for which he was found guilty. That was sexual touching.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very serious matter for which he's now serving a jail sentence for. It was a tricky matter.
Yep.
Because without going into too many details, there was some DNA evidence which was very unhelpful to his case.
Right.
It was a matter where he had to give evidence to explain what had happened, what had not happened. And it was a matter where the solicitor instructed me very early on. So as soon as he was accused, he was stood down from his job, obviously, but it was some months before he was actually charged.
Right.
Because the police continued to investigate the matter. So that ran for 2 years, and as I say, he's now serving a jail term.
Mm-hmm.
I've appeared in other matters involving people selling drugs and guns and all sorts of things, large quantities,
mm-hmm.
for which they receive lengthy jail sentences. And I have a trial coming up, which is a dangerous driving occasional death trial.
Mm-hmm.
In next month, actually, where it's a young man who is accused of not just driving dangerously, but also having alcohol in his system and other things. And it's a big matter because there are some areas of the evidence that are quite technical.
Mm-hmm.
We have two different expert witnesses. One says his blood alcohol reading would have been a certain amount. There's mm-hmm. another expert who says, no, it would have been less.
Conflicting.
We have a client who says it was his vehicle was actually struck by a kangaroo, and that's what really caused the crash. So that matter will run for about 2 weeks next month.
Yeah.
And obviously, if he's found guilty, he faces a prison sentence.
Yeah. Very hefty one, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And I guess back to that psychiatric case, that would be really hard because it is in a psychiatric hospital.
Oh, and the breach of trust is huge. And the victim was a woman who was, I think, about 50 or 60,
mm-hmm.
who had a really difficult history of mental illness. She'd been in and out of facilities a lot of her life. She'd been in and out of jail. She suffered from a condition that was so rare, a brain condition that was so rare that the Crown struggled to find an expert
mm-hmm.
who could give evidence about what her disorder was.
Right.
And I remember there was something like 700 or 800 pages of her medical notes and records.
Wow. That,
and I read every single one of them to see what was in there and to see what her mental state was at various times, which was a big issue in the trial because she did suffer from delusions at times and hallucinations and all sorts of things. And some of the things she said in the trial were obviously not real.
Yeah, that is very tricky.
It was very tricky, and the judge had to sift through all of that evidence as well.
Yeah.
For example, she said there was a garment she was wearing that she put in a package and that she sent to a relative. Her evidence was that a witch told her to place the garment in the package.
Interesting.
Okay. And this was at the time when one of the offences had occurred.
Right.
And so is she suffering from a delusion at that time? Or was she suffering from a hallucination?
Or did that happen?
And I had to ask her about it. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, yes, I remember the witch. She'd forgotten about the witch. I said, do you remember you told the police there was a witch? Oh, yes, I do. And the witch cackled at you. And so these were all very, it's very difficult when you've got a witness like that who is almost certainly telling the truth about certain things but may have experienced a delusion or a hallucination about other things.
Yeah, very difficult. So enough doom and gloom. Who would you say was or is your mentor or someone that you look up to?
Someone that I look up to. Well, the first and foremost is a local barrister called Andrew Bright, who I know you know very well.
I do.
But I knew Andrew back when I was a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually probably first met him when I was a reporter in Taree back in the year 2000 or something like that.
Yep.
And when I went to the bar, I went into chambers with him. Andrew had just opened his own chambers. And very experienced, been at the bar 35 years or something like that. And just someone you could always run ideas past, ask for help. Another one is Michael Waitman. Michael practices predominantly in family law, but he does a lot of civil law.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually one of my tutors. When I went to the bar, in your first year at the bar, you have one or two tutors who are like mentors and who supervise your work and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I picked Michael because he had a pretty broad practice. I'd seen him doing criminal matters as well as civil matters. Mm. And again, I'd ring him up and I'd borrow books off him and talk
sounding
about
bored.
Matters. Yeah. And that's one of the wonderful things about the bar is that we have an open door policy. That is, you are obliged if someone asks for help to answer their questions. And likewise, there are plenty of times when I've knocked on someone's door or picked up the phone and asked for help.
Yeah.
And they're always obliging. I'm running an appeal in the Supreme Court this Friday. I can remember before Christmas or maybe back in September, trying to put together written submissions and to figure out what the particular law was in relation. I rang a friend of mine, Phil Massey, who's been at the bar many years in Newcastle, and he's, mate, there's a case on this. Oh, there's a case. And he was so excited, he found the case for me and emailed it through straight away, and it was right on point. And so I've been very lucky, but that's part of the culture of the bar, is helping people and pointing them in the right direction.
Yeah, no, that's great. And final question, what's your advice for law students and graduate lawyers?
My advice, pay attention. Really focus on those black letter subjects that might seem tedious and boring, like torts and contracts
and constitutional
evidence, all those subjects. If you pay attention and you take good notes and you keep those notes, it's amazing how helpful they will be if you go on to become a lawyer further down the track. When you do your pracs and you're starting out maybe as a clerk or a paralegal or something, learning how to do things properly is such a huge bonus. It makes you so much more employable, it makes you so much more useful to your clients.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are the first person to master something new, you become in demand in that particular area.
Yeah.
Just the other day, I got a call from a barrister asking for some advice about a sentencing matter in a Commonwealth, for a Commonwealth offence. And Commonwealth offences have a different sentencing regime to New South Wales. This particular barrister thought I was a specialist in that area because he'd seen me run one of these matters 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
3 or 4 years ago was probably the last time I ran one of those matters.
And a lot of things can change.
But I could actually remember a lot of what the law was and what the various sections of the Commonwealth, I can't even remember what it's called, it's not the Commonwealth Criminal Code or something like that. But when you can remember all those basics and remember how to do things, what paperwork you need to have, what evidence you need to have in place, that is, those skills are invaluable.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Jess.
And good luck.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the UON Crim podcast, hosted by Jessica Horn, run by the University of Newcastle Criminology and Criminal Justice Society. I would like to thank today's guest, Stephen Ryan, and to the podcast team, Nick Minch and Zalia Windham. Please stay tuned for our next episode released on the 21st of March. You can stay up to date by following the UON CCJS on social media. See you soon!